Well, folks, once again, it's my great pleasure to welcome into the studio Dan of the Mountains.
Hi there, Mike. Back again.
Yeah. Dan Renshaw, you're back down again. Was it easier this week to come down?
It was a quick ski down the mountain today. We've had a lot of wind and not any recent snow. And it made for packed snow conditions, and it's terribly fast. So I didn't have any problem getting to the car today.
Okay. So last time we finished not quite hanging off a cliff, but we were at a place, an appropriate place for a pause.
Yeah, we were struggling getting Alan Horning, the young 14-year-old, back from his his 2-day adventure where he had his Montana cayuse, which he didn't need to have a rope on. The horse would follow him everywhere like a dog. But tied to him by a rope were two other pack animals. And they had made this adventure over Hatcher's Pass, starting from the Werbaby mine, to go to get a collection of supplies that had been warehoused at Fishhook.
Right.
And then we got him home again. And he, when we ended by... He saw his father on the trail. His father, I think one detail I failed to mention was a considerable pile of cigarette butts that Alan noted that his dad had been there for a while.
Okay.
He didn't want to go too far down the trail because he wanted the kid to do this on his own. But on the other hand, Alan noted that he'd been there for a while worrying about him.
Right.
But we got him back to the I want to say Lucky Shot because it's all the same now. The Lucky Shot mine now was discovered after the discovery of the War Baby. Same vein, but there's a considerable fault known as the Capps Fault. Capps was a USGS geologist who came into the district several times and spent enough time to identify some of the major features, faulting. The discovery of the Lucky Shot followed in about 1920. There's a lot of, when you read the accounts of it, there's a lot of what I'd call confusion about the dates on the finding of the War Baby vein. And again, the War Baby, this was a pejorative statement coming out of World War I.
Right.
And then the Lucky Shot was something that Charlie Barthoff found later. And the idea of the Lucky Shot and all of this, you know, we talked about that previously.
Right.
So we have, in the early days, the opening up of the vein on the, and again, I'm going to call it the Lucky Shot vein because it is the same vein, but it was called the War Baby Mine at the time. Outcrop. Walk right up, put your hand right on it. Gold dazzling in it, you know, gosh, you know, how much did it take to discover this? Well, it took somebody in the right place at the right time to look at it. You know, it's that simple. And Charlie, this is one of Charlie Barthoff's finds. They developed it as a winze development. There's a number of mines in the Willow Creek Mining District that were developed as a winze. And the meaning of that is that you start at the outcrop, the vein dipping into the mountain, and you would follow it then down the dip. Difficult mining doing that. But if you did a winze opening down the dip, then you could put drifts in, which are then horizontal,
right,
on the vein on either side of the winze development. And then you can mine from what are then called a level. You can mine from there up, so that the ore, when broken, comes to you.
Right.
Quite a bit of help in getting the ore into an ore car. But they developed good ore, really good ore. We don't have numbers, but I know that in the USGS documents and others, they talk about it being multi-ounce, good stuff. They built a mill in a log building. It was not a high ceiling. It was run with what's called a line shaft. and the, the line shaft, and you had a power source running the line shaft. And then you had belts from the line shaft going to the various pieces of equipment. Very dangerous arrangement because you got flying belts and pulleys.
Right. Now, when you say power source, we've talked previously about a variety of things, from different forms of water wheels to perhaps even diesel or something. What kind of power source would it there be?
That's a great question, and I shouldn't say it that way. I don't have an answer. It's a great question because I've wondered myself. There's no water available at that location, so it would have had to have been a gasoline engine.
Okay.
And this would have been a very expensive operation then because they'd have to haul all of that in by horse.
Right.
But they built this mill with this terribly dangerous line shaft, and they did quite a bit of milling and were able to, because the ore was multi-ounce, they were able to get a real decent recovery as far as the monetary part of the effort. I get a little ahead of myself. We're back. We've got the mining camp going at the, and again, I'm struggling wanting to call it the Lucky Shot, at the War Baby Mine.
Right.
A Lucky Shot has not been discovered yet. They've got a little mining camp. They've got a mill. They've got a nice, comfortable situation. Alan comes back, and he's got supplies that they had picked up at the Fishhook Inn. And this was then became a constant thing. Every week they'd go over for more supplies. It was not normal. We talked previously that if you're on the west side of Hatcher's Pass, you were probably getting supplies from Willow, from the Willow area. Willow wasn't there yet. It was starting to be there. The railroad was in the area being developed. But in the days prior to the railroad coming through and actually being able to supply with freight and so on, why, you had to go all the way to Kinnick. And the freighting from Kinnick into summer over Bald Mountain Ridge down to Wet Gulch, where there was another community with warehouses, or in the winter going around the Bald Mountain area and coming up Willow Creek with horse and sleigh. In a lot of ways, the latter was the better because they could haul more and heavier items, but then they had to store them in these warehouses.
So as you were talking about, and so far you've been looking at supplies being brought in, all these materials being brought in, I just have to ask, the gold. So once it's been milled, processed, et cetera, and you're going to take materials out, was there ever a concern about someone somehow thieving, stealing? How was that dealt with?
Fascinating, again, that it would seem to be almost axiomatic, you would have to have a holdup or two. None on record. No. I don't understand why not. Where's the bandit going to go? I mean, well, he hasn't got a lot of choices on getting out of the area. He's right. Going to be hunted down and strung up.
Yeah,
it okay. was, and it, we're talking about. They would do the retorting at the mine, so we're talking about. Everything going to a bank in Anchorage, wherever, that would be in the form of the retort sponge.
Right.
And that would be in a canvas bag usually. And I'm sure nobody would go to the bank with that alone. He probably had a shotgun carrying partner.
Yeah. Right, someone, right.
But it's a fascinating thing that I have never been able to find any detail on any kind of a theft of that while in transit.
And of course, in part that may be that I've even asked the question because I have had the experience, many people have, of all the stories of the Wild West, perhaps in the lower 48, where there apparently were occasionally, more than occasionally, thefts of
Oh, yeah.
All
oh,
the rest of it.
Fascinating stories.
Right.
I remember one that I was reading about in the Death Valley area where this guy was so sick. He was a miner, and he was doing really well. But he was so damn sick at being robbed when he left the mine, and he had a buckboard and
right.
A wagon with a single horse, and he'd go to his supply point where there was a bank. He'd never make it. He'd get robbed. So what he did was he was a silver miner. And instead of making silver bricks, he made a huge ball.
Right. The better.
And he could roll it on the wagon, and he could get there and deliver it. But by God, somebody come by and stick him up. They couldn't handle it, you know.
Sure, right. Okay. Well, that's okay. But little side note there.
Variety of so
back,
the theme. Yeah.
Back to the story now.
Yeah. Well, let's get Alan. One day he is dispatched by his father to go down to the placer mining area at Grubstake Gulch. This is down where the Grubstake comes into the Willow. There had been continuous placer mining in that area. Never anything that was spectacular, but there was multiple companies that kept trying to find a better pay zone. For some reason, they had excess mercury down there. So Alan was dispatched. He's, again, a 14-year-old kid. And he's just in love with this horse, this Montana cayuse that follows him like a dog, better than a dog, most intelligent animal he had ever been around. But the two of them, probably the dog following, would go down then from the area of the, I'm stuck on the Lucky Shot mine, down in the area of the War Baby mine, is not far down to where the placer mining was taking place, but there's quite a bit of elevation difference. So they go down there, and the miners down there were expecting Alan, and they put two flasks of mercury, one on either side of the pack board that was on his Montana cayuse. And they talk for a few minutes, and then Alan says goodbye, and they head back up the trail. Well, they didn't go very far, and the horse stopped. And the horse looked around at the load on both sides and wouldn't go any further. And Alan couldn't figure out what in the world is wrong, and he checked everything, make sure that it was tight and that the load was distributed equally on each side. He couldn't figure out why in the world this horse was being a problem. So he berated the horse. The horse was very sensitive. And he berated him and took a willow switch and hit him on the fanny a few times. So the horse put his head down, and he started up the trail. And Alan and them were lockstep up this grade. Oh, we're talking, you know, on 2 miles to get back to the War Baby mine. And finally, they didn't stop. The horse was just absolutely going to do this thing. And he gets there and delivers, unties the flasks. Now, a full flask of mercury. The flasks were usually metal with a plug in the top that was threaded. Lost in antiquity is why a flask is sold as 76 pounds of mercury, but that's the way it had always been done. And to this day, if you buy mercury, you're buying it by flask.
Okay.
Now, the flask and the mercury would come to about 100 pounds. And the reason for this particular combination is way back when the economy was essentially slaves, you know, thousands of years ago. This is what a slave was required to carry. So wherever the mining was taking place, on his backpack, a slave coming out had a flask, and that's why the size.
Oh, okay.
In a similar way, gold, bricks. I was going to propose a program just on the history of gold itself. And if we get to that, why one of those items is why, for example, in the Bible they talk about a talent as a weight of gold.
Sure.
But it's, again, that's what a slave was required to carry. That's why the size of and the dimensions. So anyway, we get these flasks delivered at the mine. Alan's father there is William Horning, takes the flasks. And then Alan takes the pack frame off the horse, and he notices blood on the blanket. And when he takes the blanket off, why, that frame had worn a hole just in those 2 miles. It worn a hole clear through the horse's hide. And it was an ugly, ugly thing. Well, the two flasks were not full. So every time the horse took a step, these things sloshed back and forth. Yeah, and that had been enough to rub a hole clear through. But Alan was so impressed that this horse would take it to heart, his berating down there, you know, that he went ahead and did this thing. Well, let's go back to the mill. The mill is running at the War Baby Mine, and there's a terrible accident happens. It was roughly 1920 by this time. One of the Barthoff clan was working in the mill for Charlie, and he had some loose clothing that got tied up in this low-lying line shaft.
Ooh.
And it wound him up in the line shaft and broke him up real badly. Don't know the details, but he was alive, but really badly hurt. And remember now, we had mentioned last time that it was necessary to do this horse pack train over Hatcher's Pass because there wasn't a road. The road came quite late. But it was the closest to get to any kind of medical help to go over the pass. So they have a stretcher. They put the guy on the stretcher, put a blanket around him. Four of them get on the stretcher, and they start off for Fishhook over Hatcher's Pass, for God's sakes. Well, it didn't get very far. It was about a mile into the trip. The guys succumbed to the stress of it all, the shock of being so badly broken up, and he died. Well, this spooked Charlie. Charlie was an interesting individual, tough prospector, pioneer type. You'd think nothing would bother him, but he was badly spooked by all of this. And he wanted out. He didn't want anything more to do with the War Baby Mine. Well, by that time, 20, he had discovered the Lucky Shot part of the vein up above.
Okay.
And the people who were doing the work on the bullion mine, that had changed hands in 1916. An interesting character out of Toronto, Canada, that comes in. And he buys the bullion mine, and when he finds out about the discovery of the Lucky Shot, why, he makes an offer to Charlie and his partners. And he acquires then the Lucky Shot and the War Baby. And now Charlie and his partner, William Horning, and William Horning's wife, Pearl, they leave. And they've got another project in mind called a Mabel Mine, and we've visited there not long ago.
Right.
But they go to the Mabel Mine and spend the 20s at the Mabel. And Alan is... By this time, he's getting old enough that he's becoming a young man, and there's no longer these usual stories about the kid growing up in the mining district. Alan is fascinated with aviation, and he spends a lot of time learning how to fly, and he becomes quite a proficient pilot. He works for McGee Airlines, which is the origin of today Alaska Airlines.
Right.
But he kind of exits the picture, and we have the Horning-Barthoff connection developing the Mabel and doing quite well. They've got a nice little milling operation going, and the ore that they find is quite rich, so they're making good money on the Mabel mine. Mabel is not far from the Gold Court. Now we're back over on the east side of Hatcher's Pass.
Mm-hmm.
Excuse me. So on that east side, you've got the developments, several, that are going on the property known as the Independence. It's not much going on there. It's mainly a case that the primary activity in the Fishhook Bowl is the gold court mine. Charlie visits there quite often, and he sees that they haven't been doing much. Really concerned about, well, why you bought this mine from us. You had big ideas. You've done some tunneling. You've built a mill, and you've done some milling. Why have you stopped? And the owner of the operation explains that the vein had been pinched out. It had been cut off. And Charlie says, can I take a look? And so they take him underground and show him, and Charlie knows exactly what's going on here, that this is a very temporary thing. If they would follow the vein a little further, they'd find that it would be much different. But they hadn't done that, so Charlie can't stand it. He makes an offer to buy the gold court mine back. So roughly 1929 or 30, I'm unsure of the date, they all move back to the gold court mine. They sell out the operation of the Mabel. They had mined what later it was determined that the primary ore zone on the Mabel, they had mined it. And when whoever took over afterwards spent a lot of frustrating time trying to find extensions.
So the right timing.
Right timing.
But it is 1929, 1930, so some things are happening about the collapse of
the economy and so
economy
on.
And
yeah,
so on.
But that didn't translate into anything having to do with an increase in the gold mining until a few years later, when the price, which was fixed by the government,
right,
when that price was allowed to go up a little bit. So the return to the gold court was, they had a mill then that they had been previously established, and sure enough, Charlie gets into the mine with a small crew, and after they were sure that they had the property tied up, why, he did some additional tunneling, and just like he thought, he got into a big wide zone in the vein, and it was very rich, and it became, as they mined it, it became phenomenal, and they took the next 7 years to mine that ore zone that they found. So good timing. Again.
Sure, sure. Here's another question for you, and I know you've had an interest in aviation, and you mentioned one individual becoming a pilot, and I'm thinking back to that time after the First World War. Aviation in the country began to develop a bit, barnstorming of one sort or another. And did aviation play any role at all in the mining district?
It did. It did indeed. Yeah, there were three airstrips that I can think of right offhand. Two at the Lucky Shot, which came later when it was developed in the 20s. They had a strip right at the mine, and then they had a better strip, a really good quality strip at Wet Gulch for many. And they had a hangar, a huge, huge hangar at this airstrip down at Wet Gulch. It was an awesome thing, an A-frame kind of a structure. I remember as a child being really impressed. Huge, huge hangar.
So it was in existence for a number of years then.
Yes, yeah. Today, it's hard to find any evidence of there ever being an airstrip there, let alone buildings. But at that time, there were a lot of buildings in the general area, warehouses, cabins for various people that lived in the area. Probably, easily a dozen or more substantial structures in the area and a community.
Just to remind people, when you say Wet Gulch, where is that?
As you, Willow Creek comes in from the Willow side of Hatcher's Pass. From west, you find the pathway of Willow Creek that goes up into and eventually right at the bottom of Hatcher's Pass is the terminus of it. But at when you follow Willow Creek downstream, when you get down to the level of the tree line, you find Grubstay Gulch, which was quite productive. The next gulch down was called Wet Gulch. The next one downstream, which is to the west. And it had gold in it, but it was never really mined. A very small amount of mining done there. A lot of prospecting. But the general flat area of the creek bottom at that area was generally known as Wet Gulch. And the reason it was just a good spot for, it was a marginal spot, but they made it good enough to land airplanes in. It was a commitment. When you wanted to land, you were committed, kind of a thing, because it was mountains on both sides.
Do you have any sense of the kind of aircraft that were used at that time?
I sure don't.
I mean, I have images of some early aircraft.
The 20s and 30s, whatever was available, yeah. I remember Alan telling the story about when he's up and has become a pilot. He flipped an airplane at the airstrip at the Lucky Shot. It was winter conditions and a lot of wind, and he had landed okay and got the plane turned around. But then upon takeoff, a gust of wind hit him just right, and he ended up upside down on the airstrip. And embarrassing.
Okay.
Embarrassing.
Crawled out, survived that in any case. Well, we have survived another audition here.
Didn't get far. I wanted to get into a story about an interesting character called Sidney Black.
Oh.
But we'll have to do that next time.
That's that. Well, we'll leave that hanging out there for the next story, and listeners can come back and we'll pick up who this character Sidney Black was.
Thanks, Mike.
Thank you, Dan.